You're listening to Grace and Fire, brought to you by Emerging Women. This is part one of a two-part conversation with Elizabeth Gilbert. Liz is the author of 2006's runaway bestseller, Eat, Pray, Love, which has sold more than 10 million copies worldwide. Her forthcoming book, Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, will hit bookstands in September of 2015. In Big Magic, Liz asks the reader to embrace curiosity and let go of needless suffering. She shows how to tackle what we love most and how to face down what we most fear. She discusses the attitudes, approaches, and habits we need in order to live our most creative lives. Liz will be a featured presenter at the 2015 Emerging Women Live Conference, October 8th to the 11th in San Francisco, California. Don't miss it. In today's episode, Liz and I spoke about how fear can block creativity, the fear we need and the fear we don't, being open to yes, but finding wisdom in the no, how inspiration promises us nothing, and finally, hard labor versus fairy dust, and the balance that Liz seeks in her own life. Here is part one of my conversation, Creating Big Magic, with the trailblazer of personal voice and creativity, Elizabeth Gilbert. Okay, hello, welcome, Liz. How are you?
Hi, sweetheart. How are you? It's nice to talk to you again.
I know. I've been looking forward to this so much, and especially since I've read the uncorrected proof of your new book, which is fantastic. So,
oh, thank you. Thank you so much for saying so.
Yeah, I love how your talk was entitled Big Magic when you spoke at Emerging Women Live in Boulder, and now I feel like I've got my hands on some serious magic here.
Oh, yeah, you got a little pre-glimpse of it, because I was sort of working out that book a bit in my talk and sort of experimenting with some of those ideas. So, yeah, now it's official and concrete and written down, and my manifesto exists.
It totally exists. And the subtitle, Creative Living Beyond Fear, is super interesting, especially since I associate you with courage. Like, you're somebody I just, you know, you feel fearless to me.
Oh, I have you fooled.
You have me sold.
Well, I hope I haven't been selling fearlessness, because fearlessness, as I explain in the book, is not something that I consider to be a virtue, and it's not something that I aspire to, and it's actually not even something that I admire. I was going to say it's not something I believe in, but I do believe in it, because I've met people who are, you know, who sort of purport to be or seem to be genuinely fearless. And Those people are psychopaths. Those people are insane, and they are dangerous people. They're emotionally dangerous. And they're also like, they seek and cause danger, and they make me really anxious, and I don't like being around them. And they also seem to be missing some really important human component. And so I have a great deal of respect for fear. And I think all of us should just take a moment to have a quiet second to thank fear for an instant in which it saved our lives. You know, the reason you and I are both here today is because there have been moments when fear quite literally saved us. And if not quite so dramatically, there have been moments where it prevented us from doing really stupid things. It's a viable and important human function. But it also can get in your way when it comes to creativity, because creativity always asks you to enter into realms with uncertain outcome, and fear hates that. And so fear always tries to shut that down. So I think what we need to do is, without trying to get in a war against fear or pretend that it doesn't exist or be ungrateful to it, we have to have a conversation with it every time we begin a new creative project that says, look, I know you're scared because you don't know what this is and you're not programmed to know what this is. But I'm going to try to write a poem. I'm going to try to paint a painting. I'm going to try to write a play. I'm going to try to expansively do something where the outcome is uncertain. And we're going to do it anyway, even though you're scared. And so it's really more about kind of working with your fear and around your fear, and not denying it and not attacking it.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, this concept of courage, like there is no courage if there's no fear.
Right. Yeah, fearless people aren't brave. Right. They're just idiots.
Right. Yeah. And you talk about the fear you need and the fear you don't. Right. We're just going to meander here, okay? Like, we're going to follow the stream. Okay. So tell me what you mean by that.
Well, look, basically what I think is that fear is one of the deepest, first evolutionary glimpses of consciousness in the human being, right? It's so important. It's so ancient. It's so vital. And not just in the human being, in like any sentient life force, right? Like you pass your hand over a tadpole in a petri dish and it flinches instinctively. Right. You know, it's at the core of survival. So it's so old and it's so important, but it's not subtle. And it's a toggle switch that just goes on and off. It doesn't have any subtlety. It doesn't have any intellect. It doesn't have any nuance. Creativity has all of those things, right? Because it's a more recent development in human beings. You know, the oldest example of human art is 40,000 years old, which is pretty old, but it's not as old as fear. You know, like creativity came into us pretty recently, and creativity is really subtle and really nuanced and really complex, and fear just doesn't get that, you know? So the fear that we need is the fear that is going to prevent you from getting into a car with a stranger, from running out into traffic, from jumping into huge waves off the coast of Hawaii when you're not a very strong swimmer, you know, from marrying a guy who says on the first date, I don't believe in monogamy, you know, like this kind of like fear responses where it's useful. Where you don't need it is in art. And yet fear doesn't know that it's not needed there. You know, it's just trying to help. It just shows up every time you're about to do something interesting, every time you're about to do something new. Fear is there to say, listen, I don't know what the outcome of this is, and just on the safe side, I'm just going to shut down the whole operation so that we don't die. And so creativity and fear have to, you know, constantly be having this conversation with each other that you, the sort of self, the capital S self, has to monitor. And you have to help fear to understand, like, thank you so much for showing up. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate how much you care about me. But actually, this is a safe situation, and no one's going to die if we take a watercolor class. You know, it's okay. And it seems dramatic to put it in those terms, but that's what it feels like. You know,
I felt like that when I'm putting myself out there, like physically, like I'm going to, like something's harm is going to come to me if I step into like too big of a space.
Dance in public.
Oh, or if you sing karaoke. Hello, sister. Saw that on Facebook. That I wanted to, like, if that was me, first of all, kudos for that. But I would feel like I was going to die.
It did feel like I was going to die. And actually, a little bit of me every time I begin a new book feels like, oh my God, I'm going to die. And you know, what do people say when they're embarrassed? They say, oh my God, I almost died. You know, they're not kidding. That's what it feels like. Because of that toggle switch, because there's no volume control on that fear toggle switch. It's either on or it's off. And when it's on, the stakes are life or death. And so the higher parts of you, the more recent parts of you, the more enlightened parts of you, the more excited, curious, creative parts of you have to constantly be in conversation with that deep old grandfather of fear. You know, and with respect, you know what I mean? Never with contempt. Whenever people say, I want to punch fear in the face, I'm always like, guys, have a little respect for this amazing energy field that has saved you, that you're here because it saved your ancestors. Like, you know, a little reverence for this thing, but also try to explain to it, it's okay. You can back down. I'm just doing a little, just taking a Zumba class.
Right.
No one's going to die. The stakes are not life or death. It's so hard to believe that. But that's the conversation that I've spent my entire life having. Every time I try to do something interesting, we have to begin that conversation again.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned the unknown, which, you know, of course, there's a lot of fear around that. But it's kind of interesting how we move and we create and we don't know what the outcome's going to be. And there's kind of, I don't know if there are two polar schools of thought, but in my own thinking, two things happen. One, I'm like, I want to say yes to everything, you know, and yes, yes, yes. And yet I love in the book where you're like, hang on a second, we need to flex the no also. And actually there's a lot of wisdom in the no. And so how do you balance that being open to everything in the universe and also look, realizing the signs that the universe, it's not always a yes.
Well, I love that you're bringing it up because, you know, we do have that bumper sticker that we all adore, jump and the net will catch you. Sometimes it doesn't. You know, sometimes it doesn't. And I feel like it's a little irresponsible to pretend that it does, you right. know, because we've all jumped and we were like, hey,
right.
that bumper sticker promised me a net. And now I quit my job to do this really brave thing. And now I can't pay my rent. And now a lot of consequences might happen, you know? And so I feel like there's, you know, I always feel better when I can personify all the different forces that are within me. And so I really do feel like I contain a family. And one of them is the really reckless kid sister, Curiosity, who has no sense of consequence, does want to try everything, does want to say yes to everything. I've got Grandpa Fear, like with the hand on the handbrake, being like, no one leaves this house. You know, I've got, you know, like, you kids get out of my yard. You know, like, I've got that in me too. And what I've discovered over the years, and I feel like this is how we start to approach wisdom, is we test out all of these different modalities, but somewhere in me, there's a self who, if I have gotten enough sleep, if I am eating well, if I am in a relationship that's nourishing, if I'm taking care of myself, if I'm calm and still, can moderate between all of those, you know, and can say to little kid sister Curiosity, hey, I love that you want to never say no to anything, but we do have a household to run here. You know, so we're going to do half of what you want, you know, and can say to Grandfather Fear, you know, thank you so much for your input, but you can put the shotgun down. Those are just trick-or-treaters.
Right.
You know, and can sort of pull, you know, but that only comes by trying and by overextending sometimes and by making mistakes and by being a little too reckless once in a while, you know, and gradually, but I feel like the really essential thing is you do have a central self who's in charge of everything. And that's the one who has to make the decisions. That's the one who has to live with the consequences. That's the one who lives in this human body, who is in relationship with other people, who has an electric bill, you know, and that person should be brought into the conversation about creativity as well.
Yeah. And, you know, the other way it plays out nicely in the talk that you gave when you were here in Boulder was that, you know, you had huge yeses for certain creative streaks, you know, with ideas for stories. And then it was like life, like put a, you know, a barrier in front of you. Okay, this isn't the way, this isn't the way. And so it seems like there's also a conversation happening with what's being presented from, you know, just life.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was doing this event recently and this woman stood up in the audience and, you know, bless her heart, she was really hurting and she was really grieving because she had taken an enormous creative risk and it had, and I'm putting this in air quotes, just as a spiritual person, it had failed,
yeah.
You know, and I'm taking it out of air quotes as a mortal saying it failed,
right.
You know, it didn't work. And she said, you know, and I brought a lot of other people into this and they believed in me and money was lost and trust was lost. And, you know, there were consequences of this risk that I took and it didn't work out. And I said, so tell me, who are you angry at right now? And she said, I'm angry at inspiration. And it was a really interesting moment for me because I was trying to figure out how to gently say this, how to respect her difficulty, her real life dilemma that she was in at the moment. But at the same time, to make very clear this belief that I've always held, which is that inspiration owes us nothing.
Mm.
It owes us, it never promised us anything. Mm. There's no contract there that says, if you try this creative thing, you will win a prize, or you will be successful, or people will love it, or it's all going to work out great, or you're going to be super happy with the result. Inspiration never, never promises any of that. The only thing that inspiration offers us is the strange, curious, magnificent, bizarre, unpredictable experience of engaging with it at all. That's what it gives you. It's like, look, you want to dance? We'll dance. And there's a part of you that has to be aware of that to just say, I'm so lucky that this thing wanted to dance with me at all, even though I don't even get what the dance was.
Yeah.
You know, like at the end, I don't even know what we just did, but man, that's a really cool and interesting way to live your life. And that unpredictability of the outcome and that consciousness that I've always had, that inspiration doesn't owe you anything more than to let you be near it, which is pretty magical and amazing enough. That's why I'm like, the pragmatic part of me is like, don't quit your day job.
Yeah.
You know, like, make sure that you're providing for yourself. You are about to engage in a force that does not operate by human mortal rules. Definitely engage with it, but keep in mind that you do have to put dinner on the table for yourself as well. And there is a way to do both of those things.
Yeah. You have a sentence in your book where you say, defend your weakness. What do you mean by that? Because I find that very interesting. Because when we have weaknesses, we always just want to like push them away and pretend that they're not there or pummel them.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't think I was saying to defend it. I think what I was talking about was the moment where I realized that I had been defending my weakness. And there's that adage that says, defend your weakness and you, sure enough, you get to keep it.
I see. Okay, I misread that. Yes.
That's what it was.
That's right.
Yeah.
It was defending your weakness. That's right.
Defending your weakness. But defending your weakness is something that we all do throughout our lives. And part of, you know, there's a balance there as well, because there's a part of your evolution where you really do at some point have to step up and own your vulnerability, as Brené Brown speaks about better than anyone alive right now. and, you know, and I love that she gives voice to that, you know. There's also been moments in my life where there's a turning point that had to happen where I had to say, all right, I've been defending this vulnerability and this weakness and giving it voice in myself for a really long time, and now it's officially holding me back. And now comes another part of me who has to say, you know, I'm just not interested in being that person anymore. I'm not interested in constantly saying, I can't do this. I'm scared. I'm afraid. I'm too fragile. I'm too vulnerable. Thank you, but now we're done. You know, now we're doing it. So it's a funny line to walk, right? There's a real discernment, because you don't want to repress your legitimate fears and vulnerabilities, but sometimes, and there are points it still happens. So like just a couple of years ago, I was working with a therapist who I really pushed back against because I was furious, because he was kind of like, I'm not going to let you just depict yourself as being as weak as you're depicting yourself as being right now. You know, and I was like, I am, I'm so weak, you know, and I was really angry. But I also just thought, wait a minute, what would happen if I kind of let that little part of me grow up, you know, and took accountability for it and owned it and got strong around it? That was kind of exciting too. So yeah, I spent my entire childhood defending my weakness because I had a mother who wanted me to be strong and I didn't want to be. I wanted to be coddled and I wanted to be babied and I wanted to be protected. And so somewhere along the line, I was like, this is getting boring.
Yeah.
It's getting a little boring being the baby. You know, I kind of want to be something else.
Yeah.
That said, there are still times when I really want to be the baby. And I have, you know, I have people in my life, like my closest, dearest friend and my husband, who when I hit that point will just be like, there, little baby. You know, it just be a baby now. And I'm so happy. It's so nourishing to be taken care of like that. But I don't want to live in that space either.
Yeah.
Not forever. Just for like a weekend.
That's what happens when I go back home, back east with my husband. We go and we visit his mother. And I'm just like, you're like catatonic. You won't do anything. You know, he just like, she's doing the laundry. She's cooking for him. He just like shows up for me. You know, meanwhile, I'm like, get the kids. But that's what happened. He regresses and it's so great. And
then he's right.
Totally ready to go after that visit. So.
Right, okay. Right. Some childhood part of him gets kind of like a battery charge from that. But
yeah. But
yeah, I mean, when you live like that forever, you end up like this 45-year-old Italian girl.
Exactly.
Who are still living with their mom.
Right. Right. I didn't sign up for that. No. So the other thing that you talk about is this sort of hard labor versus fairy dust. And I phrase it like grace and grit.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
I love the interplay of that. And I'm so glad that you address it. How has that kind of showed up in your life? Is it like 50% hard labor, 50% fairy dust, or what has been the right alchemy for you?
It depends on the day, you know, like everything else. We keep trying to, we always try to make formulas. I do too, because I always want to, I want the answer.
Yeah.
When of course all you ever get is answers. But you know, somebody said to me the other day, like, well, I don't get it. Do you believe in the muse or do you just believe in hard discipline? And I was like, yes.
Right.
The answer is yes. I believe in the muse and I believe in hard discipline. Mm-hmm. I believe in magic and I also believe in science. You know, I think that a human life is sort of a combination of those two things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so here's what I know. I know that I have I know that I have a talent, right? And I use that word from the Roman idea of the word of a talent was your payment. It was your amount of silver that you got paid for your service in the army. And everybody got a different talent based on where they were in the army, right? So I know that we all are weighted like a bag of silver. We all sort of get different weights of different talents in different areas, different payments in different areas. And the reason that I know I have a talent for language and narrative and writing is because I can compare it against other human facilities or faculties, rather, like science and math and technology, where I just don't. You know what I mean? So I can get modest and be like, oh, I don't really have a talent for writing, but I know that I'm more weighted in that direction, you know, than I am. And like, I can't, you know, I could go to a technology school forever and they could try to teach me how to fix a transmission and it's going to be really hard for me. Maybe I could learn, but there's nothing in me that will help me toward that. I don't have anything extra there, you know, but I have a little extra something where language feels like home to me. Conversation feels like home. Narrative feels like home. Reading and writing feel like home. So that was what I was given, right? I don't know why. We will never know why I got that and not other things, or why you got what you got and not other things. I decided to take that talent and invest it. And again, I'm using it as a bag of silver coins, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot you can do when you're handed a bag of silver coins. You can bury them in the backyard and never dig it up again because you're afraid somebody's going to steal it. You can squander it on cocaine and loose women.
Right.
You know, you can try to give it away to somebody else, which is, you know, by like putting all your energy into somebody else's talents. You can, mm-hmm. There's many things you can do with that. And I decided I want to like invest this in a way that will make it grow. And the way that I invest it and try to make it grow is by devoting my attention and my time to it. And as I do that, it grows. And as I do that, magical things happen, you know, and coincidences occur and the right people come into my life and I'm given ideas. It doesn't mean they always work out. As I've explained in Big Magic, lots of times they don't end how I wanted them to. But I want to engage with that mystery as much as I can. And that means being sober, being attentive, being disciplined, being reverent, and being hardworking, you know. And then will I be able to tell what I can make that little bag of silver turn into. If I don't do any of those things, that's it. You know, nothing will ever occur and the magic stops in its tracks.
Yeah. So good. Yeah. Such a good reminder. Yeah, you know, especially in this day and age where people, you know, again, they tend to be on one side of the fence or the other, where it's like, oh, it's all miracles. And, you know, we live in Boulder here. There's a lot of miracles happening in Boulder. A lot of miracles. And, you know, it's hard to just live on the miracles alone. And then they stop coming, right? Unless you really...
Right. And then you get mad.
Yes.
Then
and you're
you
like,
know.
What? I'm doing everything. I'm writing in my journal. Why am I not, you
I'm
know...
visualizing.
Where's
I'm
my check?
Right. Where is it?
I've been down that road, so I have personal, and also I've been down the grit road where
right.
I've worked my ass off for stuff, and then you just get so closed. And talk about, right. you know, being sober. It's like the farthest thing from sobriety when you're not open to what's happening right. around you. You're just becoming so focused. And
right.
the pinpoint, just, it keeps the angles keep narrowing and narrowing, and then you don't see anything.
I mean, I will sit down at my desk at 7 o'clock in the morning, which is the Yankee pragmatist in me,
yeah.
to write. and I will have had 8 hours of sleep before I begin, which is the responsible adult. And then I will say out loud to unseen and unknowable forces, come to me. I'm here. Come to me. Tell me what you want me to write. I'm here. And I'll start writing. They won't. You know what I mean? It's not like, you know, it's not like the Annunciation where suddenly like an angel comes into the room, but I begin there. You know, I begin with both of those things. I have a conversation with the mystery as I'm sitting at my desk at 7 o'clock in the morning. And then I start writing into drag, you know, but I don't sit there being like, hey, you didn't come to me. I asked you. I put the message out. They know I'm there, you know, and I'll just sludge through it, but I've got one eye open, ready for the unexpected thing,
yeah.
You know, ready for the sentence I didn't know I could write, ready for something to change, ready for something to grow. So I think there's this idea that the muse, that you are either its slave or it is your slave, right? Uh-huh. Like that's where people get stuck, where they're either like, I'm just a channel of the divine. I'm just an open, I don't even have an ego. It just pours through me. I don't know many people who actually produce stuff very well being like that, you know?
Yeah.
And then there are people who are like, I'm going to wrestle this thing to the ground and make it my own, right? I'm going to like dominate the world and my life and destiny and everything. And those are the people who come up like bloody knuckled and bruised whenever they engage with creativity. And my feeling is, I'm not its master. It's not mine. We are voluntarily collaborating with each other. I am choosing to show up and work hard. And for some reason, inspiration is choosing to engage with me. So we're not peers because we're different species, but we're collaborators. We're partnering on something. And like anything in the world, the better and healthier that relationship is, the more you get out of it.
This has been part one of my conversation with Elizabeth Gilbert. Make sure you tune in to part two as we discuss the difference between originality and authenticity, practices for increasing creativity, and much more. If you want even more Liz, sign up for Emerging Women Live 2015, where she will be giving a keynote on big magic. See you there.